Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice on WSCA 106.1 LPFM. This is Amy Antonucci, here to introduce our show to you today, May 7th, 2005. Here's what we have coming up. We'll hear Resisting Empire, a talk given in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, by Bruce Gagnon from Global Network in our first hour. In our second hour, we will hear a report by Jeff White from a protest outside of an event that our Senator Judd Gregg was speaking at. A report back from Amy Goodman's talk in Portsmouth this past week, announcements, music, and more will begin our second hour. We'll end with an episode of Between the Lines, independent radio on global issues out of Connecticut. First, let's have Jeff White with the news.
Greetings and welcome to News for Making Waves. This is Jeff, and I have some really interesting stories coming up that you'll laugh and cry and perhaps maybe even write a letter or do something like vomit. This past week in New York, invoking memories of the bombs dropped on Japan decades ago, thousands of anti-nuclear weapon and anti-war activists marched past the United Nations, where a conference was to take place on nuclear issues this past week. Organizers put the number of protesters at 40,000. Shut down everything. Testing, nuclear weapons, the war, said Vicky Downey of TESC New Mexico, came with a group calling for the closing of Los Alamos National Laboratory, where the bombs that devastated Hiroshima and Nagasaki were designed. The mayor of Hiroshima, marching with the Mayors for Peace group, said the survivors of the August 1945 bombs didn't want anyone else to endure what they did. The survivors are the only people who have had the experience of nuclear war. For them, the world is not one of us versus them. For them, the world is a family. We need to work together so that no member of this family will have to suffer the pain that they suffered in 1945. Longtime disarmament advocate Dr. Helen Caldicott said Russia and the United States are the real rogue nations and have enough weapons to destroy humankind. Let's, for God's sake, talk about the real moral issues of our time, she said. Not stem cell research, gay marriage, or abortion. Let's talk about whether or not the whole world survives. Bob Shoemaker, a Vietnam veteran from Montrose, Pennsylvania, said the public was being fed lies, as it was in the Vietnam War. I made a promise to the people I knew who died there that I wouldn't stand by and let another war happen and not speak out. 17-year-old Wesley Davis of Missouri was making his first trip to New York, accompanied by his mother, as he spoke out against nuclear weapons. And this story comes from The Guardian. Sudan's Islamist regime, once shunned by Washington for providing a haven for Osama bin Laden, as well as for human rights abuses during decades of civil war, has become an ally in the Bush administration's war on terror. Only months after the U.S. accused Khartoum of carrying out genocide in Darfur, Sudan has become a crucial intelligence asset to the CIA. In the Middle East and Africa, Sudan's agents have penetrated networks that would not normally be accessible to America, one former U.S. intelligence official told The Guardian. Some of that cooperation has spilled over into the war in Iraq. Sudan is credited with detaining foreign militants on their way to joining anti-American fighters there. News of the growing cooperation was first reported in yesterday's Los Angeles Times. The paper traced the thawing relations since 2001 to a milestone last week, the visit to Washington by Sudan's intelligence chief. Officially, Washington's position towards Sudan remains unchanged. Sudan is still considered a state sponsor of terror, a State Department spokesman said yesterday. This story from the Torah Kata. If you happened to be passing by the Israeli consulate on Thursday, you most surely would have been shocked by the unusual sight that greeted your eyes. A group of over 10,000 Orthodox Jews who were protesting against the actual existence of the State of Israel. Behind them hung large posters showing the beating of Orthodox Jews by Israeli police while they were protesting the desecration of antiquated Jewish cemeteries, which are on the path of a planned highway expansion. The protesters showed beaten and bloodied rabbis sprawled on the ground, cowering before Israeli police with stun guns and batons in their hands. Other posters showed old and young men alike being dragged on the ground and being piled into paddy wagons and taken to Israeli prisons. Other demonstrations were held in Montreal and London. This story from the Washington Times. A Venezuelan-backed TV network modeled after Al Jazeera is set to begin broadcast throughout South America. Critics fear it could become a pulpit for Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Telesur, short for Television of the South, is billed as a commercial-free, hemisphere-wide counterbalance to the North American media. It is slated to begin broadcast within a few weeks. Soon we will have Telesur, a channel with information for South American countries, because it is not possible that Venezuela and other southern countries depend only on information from CNN, Mr. Chavez said during a March press conference in Paris. And this story from the Los Angeles Times. The shops facing each other on Martyrs Square in central Baghdad say much about the state of Iraq. On one side, a coffin maker's workshop does a roaring trade. Across the road, a gun shop displays pistols and leather holsters. Death is one of the few businesses flourishing in this war-torn country. While foreign security firms make millions out of the unrest and terrorist groups pay criminal gangs to fuel it, the funeral business has never had it so good. The elderly Mahum brothers, who have been making plain wooden coffins for a decade, are struggling to keep up with demand. The coffin business is booming. Yesterday alone, 24 people were killed in Baghdad before the capital had even had breakfast. A bomb exploded outside an army recruitment center, killing at least 13. Gunmen ambushed a police convoy, killing 10 policemen. A bomb hit the deputy interior minister's convoy, killing a bodyguard. That was a relatively good day. At least 60 Iraqis were killed the previous day, and more than 200 have died in the week since the country's new government was formed. Before the war, Ali and his brother Abbas would make one coffin a day. Abbas takes little satisfaction in the boom. I suffer when I see people coming in to ask for a coffin. I see the sadness in their eyes. Sometimes I feel they hate me, but there's nothing I can do. This is my job. The price of a simple coffin has gone up from £3 before the war to about £25, a fortune for many Iraqis. The boom covers the death industry. The Wadi As-Salam Valley of Peace Cemetery in Najaf is said to be the largest burial ground in the world, a mini-city of raised tombs and sunken crypts where hundreds of thousands of Shia are buried within the site of the Imam Ali Shrine. The demand for space in the overcrowded graveyard has sent the prices of plots of land skyrocketing. This story from the Los Angeles Times as well. Defense expenditures in the U.S. will equal that of the rest of the world combined within 12 months, making it increasingly pressing for European contractors to develop a closer association with the U.S., a corporate finance group, PricewaterhouseCoopers, said. Its report, The Defense Industry in the 21st Century, adds that the U.S. is in the driving seat, raising the prospect of a future scenario in which it could dominate the supply of the world's arms completely. The U.S. defense budget reached $417 billion in 2003, 46% of the global total. This story from Angus Reid Global Scan. The mistreatment of Iraqi detainees by United States soldiers continues to affect American perceptions of the military, according to a poll by Gallup released by CNN and USA Today. 63% of respondents are personally bothered by the incidents. 37% of respondents believe American troops are still abusing Iraqi prisoners, while 49% believe the problem has been eradicated. In January, Charles Grainer, one of the soldiers allegedly involved in the prisoner abuse scandal, was found guilty of aggravated assault, maltreatment of subordinates, dereliction of duty, indecent acts, and conspiracy in a military trial. 36-year-old Grainer was later sentenced to 10 years in a military prison. May 5th, military judge James Paul declared a mistrial in the case of Lindy England, the female soldier featured in several of the abuse photographs. This story from the Asia Times. The Iraq War has strongly influenced the United Kingdom general election, seriously undermining Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was one of the staunchest supporters of United States President George Bush's Iraq policy. Although the Labour Party has been returned to office for a third term, its majority is sharply reduced and comes back into government on just 36% of the vote, the lowest ever percentage in British electoral history. the Conservative Party received 33%, and the anti-war Liberal Democrats, also known as the Ditch Blair Project, shot up to 23%, getting their largest number of seats since 1923. The result almost certainly means that Blair will not serve a full term as premier. He has already conceded that Iraq seriously harmed his party's standing. At least 50 strongly anti-war Labour members of parliament have been re-elected, meaning Blair will find it difficult to manage his rebellious party with such a sharply reduced majority. When the UK general election was called, the ruling Labour Party expected to be re-elected with another big majority. The British economy is strong, the opposition party is relatively weak, and Labour is widely considered to have done a good job in office. However, as has already happened in Italy and Spain, the political fallout from the Iraq War has yet again cast a dark shadow over another European election. Labour's main electoral problem was Blair's deep unpopularity. His reputation suffered a severe battering due to the staunch support of the US-led invasion of Iraq. Blair was once seen as his party's greatest asset, but this time was considered its biggest liability. The surprise of the election was the incredibly strong showing of the anti-war Liberal Democrats in many normally safe Labour seats. They gave Labour a real run for their money and managed to pick up many more seats than the pollsters had predicted. Blair himself won comfortably in his own seat, but faced an uncomfortable challenge from an independent candidate whose young son was killed in Iraq. One of the most astounding results was the victory of the fiercely anti-war candidate George Galloway, who stood in one of Labour's safest seats and against the odds won. Galloway was a former Labour MP when Blair expelled him from the party for his outspoken criticism of the war. In a powerful victory speech, he attacked Blair, saying, "All the people you killed, all the lies you have told, will come back to haunt you. The best thing the Labour Party could do is sack you tomorrow morning." And finally, we have a wonderful Mother's Day story from the Associated Press. A high school student was suspended for 10 days for refusing to end a mobile phone call with his mother, a soldier serving in Iraq, a school official said. The 10-day suspension was issued because Kevin Frankois was defiant and disorderly and was imposed in lieu of an arrest, Spencer High School Assistant Principal Alfred Parham said. The confrontation Wednesday began after the 17-year-old junior got a call at lunchtime from his mother, Sergeant First Class Monique Bates, who left in January for a one-year tour with the 203rd Forward Support Battalion. Mobile phones are allowed on campus but may not be used during school hours. When a teacher told him he had to hang up, he refused. He said he told the teacher, "This is my mom in Iraq. I'm not about to hang up on my mom." Parkham said the teen's suspension was based on his reaction to the teacher's request. He said the teen used profanity when taken to the office. Can't imagine why. Kevin got defiant and disorderly, Parkham said. When a kid becomes out of control like that, they can either be arrested or suspended for 10 days. Now, being that his mother is in Iraq, we're not trying to cause her any undue hardship. So he was suspended for 10 days instead. Imagine that. And that's the news on Making Waves, and happy Mother's Day to everybody out there, and especially all the mothers who have lost children in places like Iraq and other senseless wars. Happy Mother's Day.
Resisting Empire, a talk given by Bruce Gagnon in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, in March 2004, is coming up next. Bruce is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons in Space, based in Maine. He came at the request of Seacoast Peace Response, and Stanley Longstaff recorded his presentation for us to hear now.
I want to start out to tell you a little bit more about myself. It's always nice to know something about your speaker, I think. I grew up in a military family, an Air Force family. We moved around all the time when I was growing up. In 1968, we were living up in the panhandle of Florida. It's so conservative there, people call it Lower Alabama. And I had my first organizing experience at that time. I was 16. And I was the vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club. And I did such a good job working on that campaign for Nixon that they had this big fish fry fundraiser. And they asked me to sit at the head table with their guest speaker that night. You've probably heard of him, recently died. Guy by the name of Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. And then in 1971, I tried to join the Air Force and actually flunked my induction physical because of an old high school football injury. And so at a time when most people of good sense were trying not to go into the military, I had to get a waiver to get in. And after my training, I was sent to a base in California that was an airlift base for the war. And GIs would come from all over America and get on the planes to go to Vietnam. And when the planes would come back, they would bring the body bags of the dead soldiers. And so almost on a daily basis, just across the street from where I worked on the flight line, you would see the rows and rows of dead bodies returned. This created a dynamic at our base, and on the weekends, people would protest every weekend outside the gate, usually just a few people. But little did they know that the 15,000 permanently stationed GIs on our base and the thousands of them that came and got on the plane going back and forth to Vietnam, all of our lives were in some way touched by their protest. And the day that I checked into the barracks, my first day there at this base, they looked down this clipboard and they said, "Oh my God, we've only got one room left. Really, we're sorry. We'll get you out of there as soon as we can. Get your bags." And so we walked down this long, dark hallway, last door on the left, and the guy kept apologizing to me over and over again. "Really, we'll get you out of here as soon as we can." And I thought it would be a little broom closet, literally with a cot in it, and I would spend two or three nights in there. And when he opened the door and we walked in, there were anti-war posters all over the wall. Come to find out, it was the leading GI resistance movement organizer in the barracks. And they were trying to kick him out, but they didn't have enough stuff on them yet, so in the meantime, they were keeping them isolated. But they had run out of rooms. And then they forgot about me. And so at night, there was a knock on the door, and white guys would come in with chairs, and they would sit in a circle, and they would talk about the war. And I'm sitting in the corner, this young Republican for Nixon that I was, thinking, "These must be communists." Another night, there was a knock on the door, and black guys came in with chairs, and they sat in a circle, and they were Black Panthers from the cities, talking about racism. And I'm sitting in the corner, thinking, "These must be communists." And then they started smoking marijuana. Now, I want you to know I had heard of it before. And I promise you, I never, ever inhaled. Not one time did I ever do that. But slowly my chair moved into their circle as I began to hear what they had to say. It started making sense. It was the first time in my life, my sheltered life, if you will, that I had heard a lot of this stuff. And then what kind of topped it all off for me was reading the Pentagon Papers, the government's own secret history about how our own government fabricated the pretext to get into the war in Vietnam. And so at that point, all of my illusions were shattered. My entire life was turned upside down. And I decided I was a conscientious objector, and I wanted to be released. And so I went to the people, and I asked them to be released as a CO. And of course, their first question to me, because everybody those days was practically claiming to be a conscientious objector. And so they asked me, "Well, what's your family history? Are you from a traditional peace church?" And I said, "Well, no, actually, I'm a young Republican for Nixon from a military family, you know." So they turned me down. So I did 3.5 years of what I called hard time. Because after I really figured out what was going on, it was real, real hard for me to be there. And then when I got out, I was going to college at the University of Florida, just ready to graduate. And I got recruited by the United Farm Workers Union to organize fruit pickers for Cesar Chavez's union. And so I left college, never to return, and there became a professional organizer. And from there, I went on to work for 15 years as the state coordinator of the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice. And in that job, I began to take people to the Space Center, the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, over and over and over again, as we began to learn about how the military has taken over the space program. And so I want to share with you some of the things that I've learned in these last 20-some years about what's happening to the space program today. You recently might have heard about the controversy surrounding this Pentagon office called the Information Awareness Office. A former Iran-Contra figure, John Poindexter, a Navy admiral, was in charge of this office. Their job was to create new technologies to essentially data mine the American people. Data mine means begin to establish computer dossiers on all of you, what you eat, what you drink, where you go, what you shop, what you read, everything about you. And they're creating these new computer-based technologies to do so. Well, it became so controversial that the very first thing they did at the Information Awareness Office was pull off their, off from their website, their logo of the all-seeing eye. And then Congress had to even intervene and close it down. But what they did was they broke the information awareness jobs into many, many different new areas, sending it to Homeland Security and then throughout the Pentagon. So the work is still going on today. And so this is just some of the things that they're working on, things like biometric signatures of humans and all kinds of things that would allow the government to begin to essentially control our lives. This is another thing the technologists and militarists are working on today. This is from an Air Force website. The headline of this reads, "Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. Come to find out, the military is doing weather modification experimentation because they plan to use weather as a battlefield weapon. They say they want to be able to make it rain before we go in and invade someone, so that they get bogged down in the mud, and it's easier for us to go in and take them out because they can't get their planes off the ground or they can't move their tanks, etc. Or we want to be able to create a drought condition before we go in and take them over, meaning that a refugee situation would ensue, making it a lot easier for the United States to go in and take over that particular territory. And you might have heard of a program that the military is working on today called HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, up in Alaska. The idea is that we're going to directed energy weapons up to the ionosphere so that we can actually lift the ionosphere, allowing us to interfere with global communications and change weather around the world. So that when you begin messing with the balance of nature, literally playing with the creation, if you will, you are going to set in motion then a whole disruption of the planetary ecosystem. And as I travel, as much as I do, everywhere I go, people are always talking about, you know, it's funny, the weather here has really changed in recent years. It's different. It's strange weather patterns now. And so we hear that all the time. And so I would submit to you that the militarists, the technologists, and the scientists need to be held accountable to what they're doing by the American people and the people of the world. And that's what our organization, the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, is about. We were created in 1992 and today have 180 affiliate groups all over the world who are working to stop this nuclearization and weaponization of space and to stop the use of space for control and domination on the Earth. This is a planning document by the United States Space Command, and you see the satellite hitting targets on the Earth below. The Space Command is headquartered at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado. And on their headquarters building, they have their logo that reads Master of Space. I like to call it Master of Disaster. Let's take a look at some of the language in this planning document. They say that in the future, because of corporate globalization of the world economy, the Pentagon expects that there's going to be a widening gap between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots around the world. And as a result of that, the Pentagon says there's going to be more and more regional instability around the world as workers kick up because they're under the boot of these multinational corporations. And they say, you know, we can't, try as we may, put a Marine on every single street corner of the world to suppress these populations for the interest of the multinational corporations. But with space technology in place, the Pentagon says, we, the United States, will be able to hear everything on the Earth because we now can intercept all phone, fax, and emails from every corner of the planet via space technology. We will be able to see everything on the Earth and ultimately target everything and every place on the Earth. And they go on to say that space superiority will emerge as an essential element of battlefield success. in future warfare. I think this New York Times Sunday Magazine story from 1999 makes a similar case, written by the well-known columnist Thomas Friedman, entitled What the World Needs Now. He says, for globalism to work, America can't be afraid to act like the almighty superpower that it is. Friedman says, for McDonald's to flourish around the world, we can't be afraid to use the airplanes made by McDonnell Douglas. Well, for the last 4 years, I'm on the road about 2 weeks of the month, traveling around this country and around the world. And 2 years ago, I was in France doing a speaking tour of about six cities. And every city that I went to in France, when I showed this, there was a very strong reaction in the audience. And you know what they told me? They said during World War II, our country was occupied by the Nazis for several years. Over half of France was occupied. They said, we know what fascism looks like. We know what it smells like. And we know what it tastes like. And your country is fascist. And you, American people, don't even know it. Now, imagine, how do you respond to that? Now, getting back to this vision for 2020, here they get right down to it. They talk about how the United States is going to dominate space and how we're going to control space. And they define it. Control of space is the ability to assure access to space, freedom of operations within the space medium, and I think most importantly of all, they say, an ability to deny others the use of space. We, 5% of the world's population, are going to deny other countries the use of space because we're going to be the masters of space. Well, if you really want to understand the U.S. space program today, I think you have to go back to the origins of it. And to find the origins, you have to go back to Nazi Germany. Hitler sent Major General Walter Dornberger to recruit a brilliant young rocket enthusiast by the name of Werner von Braun that had a weekend rocket club. He got him to come to work for the Nazis. They made von Braun an SS officer. And for von Braun and his rocket team, they built a place called Peenemünde, a rocket launch and test facility where the V-1 and V-2 rockets that Hitler used to terrorize the cities of London and Paris and Brussels with it at the end of World War II. This is where they were constructed and tested. And they brought to this place thousands of Jews and French resistance fighters to serve as slaves for the rocket operation. The British found out about it and went in and bombed the entire operation. And so the Germans said, we have to move to a more secure location. And so down inside of central Germany, there's a mountain chain called the Harz Mountains. And inside the mountain, the Nazis had a huge tunnel where they were storing military hardware. They cleared it out. They moved the whole operation into this place and named it Mittelwerk. And just outside of Mittelwerk, the Nazis built a brand new concentration camp called Dora. And to Dora, they brought 40,000 Jews, gypsies, communists, homosexuals, French resistance fighters. Even a black American GI prisoner of war were brought there to serve as slaves for the Nazi rocket effort. Well, the slaves began to sabotage the entire operation. They left screws unturned. They urinated on the wires so that when von Braun and his team were launching the rockets, they were going haywire. And so they sent their team in to find out who is doing this. They identified 100 of the slaves and summarily hung them in front of everyone as a warning that you will not interfere with this rocket effort. Well, the day that this picture was taken, the Allies had closed in even on this place too. And von Braun and his team knew that they would be accused of crimes against humanity if they remained at this place. So they fled for the hills and they were caught. One of the first to arrive was an 18-year-old American GI by the name of Hugh Carey, later became governor of New York State. And he said that when they arrived, they did find some survivors, some emaciated human beings. But they also found, lying at their feet, waiting to be shoved into the crematory ovens, thousands of dead bodies. They discovered that 25,000 of the 40,000 slaves at this place perished at the hands of the Nazis. Well, you know, after the war, the United States and the Allies did create the Nuremberg trials, at which time we did bring the Nazis to justice for their crimes against humanity. But 1,500 of the top Nazis never went to trial. They were smuggled into the United States by the U.S. Army through Boston and West Palm Beach, Florida, in a program called Operation Paperclip. Now, who are these Nazis that were brought to the United States? They were Nazi intelligence that had all the names of the communists throughout Europe. They were brought to America to create the CIA. Then there were the Nazi scientists that were taking Jews in Nazi Germany and doing mind control experiments on them. They were brought to the United States, where in the 60s they were doing the MK Ultra and the LSD drug experiments. You've all probably heard the stories about how people were jumping out of windows back in the 60s. These were the Nazi scientists. Then there were the Nazi scientists that were taking Jews and putting their bodies in freezing temperatures to see how a downed pilot would react if he was shot down over the Baltic Sea. They were brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to create the United States Air Force Flight Medicine Program after the war. And then there were 100 of the scientists, Wernher von Braun and his rocket team, along with 100 copies of the V-2 rocket. And they were sent to Huntsville, Alabama, to create the United States Space Program. Von Braun became the first director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. The former flight test director up at Peenemünde along the Baltic Sea, Kurt Debus, became the first director of the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. And the former commissioner of the Third Reich, Major General Walter Dornberger, the guy that recruited von Braun for Hitler, became vice president of Bell Aerosystems Corporation in New York, that made its riches building the helicopters for the war in Vietnam. And when NASA was created right after the war as a civilian agency, the military freaked out. You can't do that. You can't have a civilian space agency. The military has to be in charge of space. Don't worry. Don't worry, they were told. From the first day, we're going to have an oversight committee to ensure that the Pentagon controls the space program. And Major Walter Dornberger was appointed to the oversight committee. In fact, in 1958, Dornberger testified before the Congress of the United States, saying that America's top space priority should be to, quote, conquer, occupy, keep, and utilize space between the Earth and the Moon. Later on, in a speech before a National Missile Industry Conference, Dornberger said, "Gentlemen, I didn't come to this country to lose the Third World War. I lost two." And then finally, the guy that cracked the whip on the slaves, the slave driver, if you will, inside the mountain tunnel at Middlework, the head of production, Arthur Rudolph, became the project director for NASA's Saturn V rocket program that took the United States to the moon. So these are the origins of the U.S. space program. And so today, when we see the slogan, Master of Space, do we see an ideological similarity between that and Hitler's slogan, Deutschland über alles, Germany overall? And do you think that when you take 1,500 of the top Nazi scientists and infuse the military-industrial complex of America with them, at every level, virtually, is there an ideological contamination that goes along with it? The Pentagon brags that the Persian Gulf War in the early 90s that we had with Saddam Hussein was actually the first space war ever. With U.S. satellite technology, we were able to pre-identify all of Saddam Hussein's military targets before the war began. And in the first 2 to 3 days of that war, we bombed over 95% of Saddam Hussein's targets, intentionally leaving in place a tiny sliver of capability that we then played cat and mouse with during the remaining weeks of the war, where we used 100 cruise missiles at $1 million apiece, tested out new stealth bombers and new laser weapons. And at that time, a guy by the name of Charles Horner was commander of the Space Command, and he says, "We came out of the war deeply sensitized to the value of space. Future military success," they said, "will depend on space capabilities." So they realized that whoever controlled space was going to literally control the Earth. And so since that time, the Pentagon has come out with a new policy directive saying that we, the United States Pentagon, have the right to deny other countries access to space, that we must dominate space, and most importantly, in order to destroy other countries' space assets, their satellites, we must develop the capability or the tools or the weapons to carry out the mission to neutralize other countries' space assets. The day after Secretary of War Rumsfeld was sworn in to his current post by George W. Bush, he released a report to the nation called the Rumsfeld Space Commission Report. During the out years, Rumsfeld had been a key player keeping the momentum and the pressure on to keep Star Wars alive. And this is a page from that report. I want to read you one line. In the coming period, the United States will conduct operations to, from, in and through space in support of its national interests, both on Earth and in space. I want you to hang on to these words, interests on Earth and in space. We'll come back to them later on. And with this came this picture of a new military doctrine called full spectrum dominance. The idea is that the United States must dominate every level of conflict. We have to dominate the Earth with our army, with our Navy, dominate the seas, dominate the air above us with our Air Force, and we must dominate space with our new generations of weapon systems and satellites that are now being developed. So this particular advertisement by General Dynamics really lays it out. No matter whether you're a troop on the ground, in a tank, on a boat, or on a plane, all warfare today is coordinated by space technology. And I think most of you have probably heard of this program called National Missile Defense, right? The idea that we have to have a bullet, hit a bullet way up into deep space to protect the continental United States from attack by the rogue states. So North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, none of which have nuclear missiles. And now China, we're told, with its 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the United States, might attack us. And so therefore, we have to be able to have a bullet, hit a bullet in deep space to protect us from attack. Well, I would submit to you that this idea of national missile defense is a Trojan horse. It doesn't have anything to do with defense whatsoever. It's about controlling space, dominating space, denying other countries access to space. It's about the United States becoming the master of space. But this program is going to be so expensive, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And so they know the American people aren't going to hand over the national treasury unless they're able to terrify them. And that's how that's why they trot out, of course, the rogue states. And so in order to pay for this then, we're going to have to cut Social Security. We're going to have to cut health care. We're going to have to cut education. We're going to have to cut environmental cleanup. Our children's future, all the good things that we rely on to have real security in our lives, are going to be cut in order to pay for this program as it stands today. But there's a whole other program underway besides national missile defense, besides having a bullet, hit a bullet in deep space. Another program is underway called theater missile defense, TMD. And the idea of this program is you don't wait till the missile gets way up into deep space. You forward deploy your systems. You surround the so-called offending rogue state. So as soon as they try to launch anything, you hit it immediately in what's called its boost phase because you're right there on their doorstep. And so this program, theater missile defense, is now moving forward as a preferred deployment option of both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Congress of the United States. So this is how it works. Up at Bath Iron Works in Maine, the Navy is building Aegis destroyers that are going to be outfitted with theater missile defense systems. Their job would be then to hit missiles immediately after they're launched because they're right there on the shore. The Army would have ground-based launchers, and the Air Force is working on a thing called the airborne laser, a converted Boeing 747 with a laser beam on its nose, flying 24/7, knocking out other countries' missiles immediately after they're launched. And all of this would be coordinated by a whole new generation of military warfighting satellites that are under development today. And they say they're going to deploy it right off the coast of China. who I told you has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the United States. We have 7,500 nuclear weapons of our own. Clearly, China is not going to attack the United States. If you've been to the store lately, you see that virtually every product in America is made in China. They're going to attack one of their best customers? I don't think so. So then what's really going on? Why are we going to do this? Well, this article, I think, from the Washington Post really tells the story. The headline is, "For the Pentagon, Asia Moving to the Forefront." And the article says, "We're going to manage China." Now imagine that. We're going to manage China. We're going to double our military presence in the Asian Pacific region. Today, we've lengthened and widened the runways on Guam and Wake Island in the Pacific to handle the B-1 and B-2 bombers. We've already pre-positioned cruise missiles on Guam, and now we're going to move to deploy theater missile defense systems surrounding China. Well, let's take a look at the map. This is what we call our unsinkable aircraft carrier, Japan, where today we have 40,000 U.S. troops deployed, and we're going to put theater missile defense there. And right next door in South Korea, where today we have 40,000 U.S. troops deployed, we're going to put theater missile defense there. And we're going to put it 90 miles off the coast of mainland China in Taiwan. And we're going to put it in Australia. And we're going to put it on ships and planes, beginning a coastal encirclement of China. And so, of course, the question is, how is China going to respond to this provocation by the United States? And they've already told us they're going to have to build more nuclear missiles. Well, you know, I didn't used to look over here into this region called Central Asia until after 9/11. But after having, I told you the story about when I was in the Air Force and I read the Pentagon Papers, it taught me a lesson, always to ask the next question. Who? What? Why? When? How? And so the day after 9/11, admittedly, not knowing much about this region, I went to my world atlas, and I looked up these countries, and now, of course, we all know, people are talking about it, that they have some of the largest deposits of oil and natural gas in the entire world, in this region of Central Asia. Uzbekistan has the world's largest single gold mine. And so today, I think you've all heard George Bush say it, "The American people had better be patient. It's going to be a long, long war." Any of you heard him say that? So as we now look over here, the United States is setting up permanent bases in Afghanistan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan as we begin an inland surrounding of China. And just on Russia's southern door, if we had tried to do this during the height of the Cold War, we would have had nuclear war over it. Recently, I saw this advertisement in one of the industry publications, and it really struck me. What struck me was this little insert map. And if you look at it very closely, you see that this is the very part of the world I was just referring to. Coastal China. And so this is their vision for theater missile defense. This is their vision for how we're going to get right up alongside of China. And so we can manage them. How many of you have heard of a guy by the name of Zbigniew Brzezinski? Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. Condoleezza Rice has the equivalent job today in the Bush administration. He wrote a book in 1997 called The Grand Chessboard. And this is a page from his book where he talks about these oil and natural gas deposits in this region. He talks about the importance of getting control of the region so the United States oil corporations can build pipelines to move the oil and natural gas through the region. And you might barely be able to see it right here through Afghanistan where the pipeline is. He has it labeled as Unocal Pipeline. And in fact, that same year that the book was written in 1997, I recently read a testimony on the Congressional Record website, a Unocal vice president testifying before the Congress of the United States, imploring the Congress to help Unocal by putting a more compliant government into Afghanistan so that Unocal could get permission to build the pipeline through the region. So their ships could then move the oil and natural gas through the Arabian Sea to emerging ports around the world, especially in the Asian Pacific region. And another page from the Brzezinski's book, though, lays out what he calls two key collision points. He says, we won't be successful in this plan unless we control two key collision points, one being the coastal region, where today we're moving to deploy theater missile defense, and the other, the inland border, where today we're going to be there for a long, long time. And I would submit to you that this so-called war on terrorism is really a front. There's a larger geopolitical strategy underway here, and the American people have taken the bait. In another one of their planning documents of significance at the Space Command called the Long Range Plan, here you see their vision, not just control of the Middle East, not just control of Central Asia, but control of the entire planet. The successor to the shuttle, what they call the military space plane, whose job it would be to fly down from orbit, drop an attack, and then go up again. And then the space-based laser, what the Pentagon calls the Death Star, powered by nuclear reactors, by the way. Well, you know, just the last 2 years, I read in Aviation Week and Space Technology, an industry publication that I follow, a report on a computer war game at the Space Command headquarters at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, set in the year of 2016. The computer war game was the red team versus the blue team, the United States versus China. And in that computer war game, the United States launched a preemptive first strike attack on China. And the first weapon that we used in that attack was the military space plane, the successor to the shuttle, that flew down from orbit, dropped an attack on China, and went back up again. And then the second attack on China was from deep space with the space-based laser firing and hitting targets on the Earth. And of course, its other job will be to destroy other countries' satellites, knock them out, giving the United States control of space, denying other countries access to space. In 1989, I organized a demonstration at the Kennedy Space Center, one of many that I've done over the years, but that particular one was important to us because we had an Apollo astronaut come speak, Edgar Mitchell, one of the early moonwalkers. First time an astronaut had ever gone to such a demonstration, and he spoke out against weapons in space, saying we can't let the Pentagon put weapons in space, even to test them. He said because what they will do is create so much space junk, orbiting debris, that we will not be able to get a rocket off the planet Earth. Come to find out today, there are 110,000 pieces of space junk larger than a half of an inch, tracked on the big radar screens at NORAD in Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, rotating the Earth at 18,000 miles an hour. And Mitchell says that you would not literally be able to get a rocket off the planet because it would be like going through a minefield. It would be destroyed. Recently, the International Space Station that's being built just above the planet, originally it was going to cost you taxpayers $10 billion. Now the price tag has grown to $100 billion. They had to move it to another orbit because they were tracking space junk that was coming dangerously close, and they were afraid it was going to destroy the space station. And they point, this is a Harper Magazine story, by the way, and they point to this one speck right here, and they say this is one of 34 nuclear reactor cores that will fall back to Earth in the next 1,000 years. Come to find out, since the beginning of the space age in the 60s, the United States and the former Soviet Union have launched 40 military satellites orbiting the Earth powered by uranium or plutonium, several of which have fallen back to Earth already. 1964, a U.S. military satellite called SNAP-9A with 2 pounds of plutonium fell back to Earth, just like the Columbia shuttle last February, remember? How it broke apart and scattered its debris over Texas and Louisiana. Well, that 2 pounds of plutonium was turned to dust as it burned up on reentry and was carried by the winds across the planet to be ingested by the people of the Earth into our lungs and then passed on through our reproductive organs for generations after generations after generations after generations to come. And now the Bush administration has come out with a program called Project Prometheus and major expansion of nuclear power into space. You remember earlier I asked you to hang on to some words, national interest in space? We're going to talk about them now. You all know that a few weeks back, Bush made his big announcement, Moon and Mars announcement. This is what we're going to talk about. According to this book by a NASA scientist, there's gold on the asteroids, there's magnesium and cobalt and uranium on Mars, and there's helium-3 and water on the Moon. And whoever gets to these planetary bodies and controls them is going to be rich beyond anything imaginable. I want you, this is a New York Times story, take out the word mine, and in its place put in the word own. The author asked the question, will the Moon become the Persian Gulf of the 21st century? He says, with helium-3 on the Moon, it could be used to power fusion reactors once the dwindling supplies of fossil fuels run out on Earth. And he said it'll make the profits of the oil corporations look like nothing. But it's a question, who's going to own the Moon? The 1979 United Nations Treaty, the Moon Treaty, says nobody, no corporation, no individual, no country can claim ownership of the Moon. The Outer Space Treaty of 67 says nobody can claim ownership of any of the planetary bodies. The heavens are the province of all humankind. Guy, you might recognize this name, Harrison Schmitt, a former astronaut, former senator from New Mexico, is a geologist by trade, and he's created a corporation that wants to go and mine the Moon. And he and others are working to essentially get rid of the United Nations space law and to rewrite space law, giving these aerospace corporations the right to go and claim ownership of the planetary bodies. This is a brand new document from the Air Force Space Command, an update of their planning document. I want to show you just one line in this planning document. They say, while our ultimate goals are truly to exploit space, we cannot fully exploit that medium until we first control it. And so I realize that the United States Space Command, their job is not just to give the corporate elite control of the Earth. Their other job is to create parallel military highways between the Earth and the Moon, and the Earth and Mars, and the Earth and the other planetary bodies, so that when the day comes when they can successfully mine the sky, they will control the shipping lanes of the future. Think of it like Columbus. Remember, Columbus was sent by Spain, Queen Isabella, to go out and find the New World. And when he came back, what's the first thing Spain did? They began the 100-year process of building the Spanish Armada to go out and protect their new interests and investments in the New World. And of course, this is what created the global war system. As soon as all the European powers were building navies so they could go out and protect the new resources and the new potential markets in the New World. And they were all slitting each other's throats to do so. And this is why the United Nations, much to their credit, created the Moon Treaty and the Outer Space Treaty, looking ahead, realizing that as we inevitably move off this planet, we must do so in a way that we don't carry this bad seed of war and greed with us into the heavens. This is a book commissioned by the Congress of the United States. They asked this congressional staffer, John Collins, to write the definitive study. How's this whole thing going to work? They're planning ahead, just like Queen Isabella. And this is his 50-year plan report to the Congress. And you know how people sign the foreword of a book? They recommend it. They endorse it. You see some names here, John Glenn. Bill Nelson used to be the congressman from Cape Canaveral. He went up on the space shuttle one time. Now he's one of the two Democratic senators from Florida. Well, let's take a look at some of the language in this book, this congressional study. The author says, I think this is one of the more interesting things in here, is this whole idea about the Earth-Moon gravity well. He says, think of it like a wishing well. Imagine someone is down inside the bottom of a well, and you put a lid on at the top. They can't get out, right? Or it's like controlling the front gate of a military base. You control the gate, you control who gets on and off the base. Well, the author says, that with U.S. bases on the moon, something that Bush just announced that we're going to do is set up permanent bases on the moon. And with bases on the moon and with armed space stations at the L4 and L5 positions, the author says we, the United States, will be able to control who gets on and off the planet Earth. And he goes on to say, with our armed forces lying in wait at that location, we could hijack rival shipments upon return, because we're going to be the masters of space. And he says, fundamentally, none of this is possible without nuclear reactors. Nuclear reactors thus remain the only known long-lived compact source able to supply military space forces with the kind of multi-megawatt power they're going to need. Larger versions, he says, of these nuclear reactors could meet the needs of things like space-based lasers, neutral particle beams, mass drivers, and railguns. Nuclear reactors must support major bases on the moon until better options, yet identified, become available. And so here we have it then, the complete nuclearization and weaponization of space. A conjunction of interests at work, friends. The aerospace industry, the Air Force, the Pentagon, NASA, the Department of Energy, nuclear academia, all coming together to promote this nuclearization and weaponization of space. You know, as I travel, I was telling you I do a lot of traveling, and most of the time, just like tonight, I speak in the evening, and after I speak, I always go outside, and the first thing I do is I look up for the moon. Every night in a different shape. Funniest kind of stories I could tell you about the places I've been around the world, and I've seen the moon in contrast hanging over this god-awful, huge Los Angeles. I was standing on the second floor of the Catholic Worker House in Los Angeles, and there was the moon just hanging over the city. And then I was up in Taos, New Mexico, where it was sitting right in the crest there, being like held amongst the mountains. And so all over the place I've seen this thing. And as I do this, I begin to realize that this night sky is, and the moon are the unifying symbols for all the people on the earth. Every one of us has some kind of relationship with this night sky. For thousands and thousands of years before us, our relatives sat around their council fires at night talking about the sky and wondering, where did we come from? What happens when we die? What is the meaning of life? These are the real questions that are deep, deep, deep in all of us. And now during our time, in our country, with our tax dollars, our government is now saying that they're going to move the arms race into the heavens and that they are going to control and dominate space. Well, we say no in the global network. And we have been working to create a global consciousness and a global movement around this issue. And what we did early on was to look at where the Space Command units are all over the planet. We realized that they have set up essentially space bases all over the world. Now, why would they do that? As satellites orbit the Earth, they feed the information directly to the Earth below them as they pass. And so the United States has had to set up these bases, what are called downlink facilities. They look like this. This one is in the middle of the bush country in Australia. It's called Pine Gap. They receive the information from the satellites, and then they beam it on back through another satellite back to the United States. Just last year, our friends in Australia traveled 1,500 miles out into the bush country. It took them 2 days to get there. They took 500 people there for a protest because they wanted to say, no, you're not going to use this base to create war in space. We don't want our country to be part of this program.
That was Bruce Gagnon with Resisting Empire.